Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio, bringing you Politics Uncensored for another week. And what a week we have had in the world of Westminster and politics. Everybody fighting everybody. The Conservatives are withdrawing support and expelling people. Labour are withdrawing support and expelling people. I have yet to be expelled, which is probably the biggest news of the week. But we'll keep that timeline going as to when that happens, and I'll keep everybody informed. We've got a really, really brilliant show. We're switching up a little bit this week, and we'll probably be doing that in the future. And we're going to be doing more stories throughout the show. So rather than focusing on one particular theme, we're going to be throwing more at you with more stories and more guests, and hopefully you will enjoy hearing about more issues on the show, and I'm really, really excited to do that. So this week we've got Vincent Hornsbury, mortgage and protection advisor at the Mortgage Advice Bureau, speaking to us about mortgages now that the economy is officially, or the country is officially, in recession. We'll get to hear from him about home ownership. We've had Michael Gove pipe him up this week about how the Conservatives can secure the next generation of all people. They've sent Michael Gove to convince the next generation. That's like sending a snowman to argue for the summer. But maybe he'll have more success, and I'm being cynical. But so we'll have Vincent Hornsbury joining us from the Mortgage Advice Bureau. We've also got John Bowden, a Washington correspondent at The Independent, joining us. The American elections are fast approaching, and we are going to most likely have the choice, or the Americans voters will most likely have the choice between Joe Biden, the current president, and the former president, Donald Trump. And we're going to be discussing who's older. Are either of them fit to hold office? Can either of them finish a sentence? We're going to be talking to John Bowden about that from The Independent. But before we get to that, we've got The Week Unwrapped, where we talk about the biggest political stories of the week. And rejoining us in the studio, we've got Councillor Hamza Tazel, former Lord Mayor of Westminster, joining us. Hamza, how are you doing, man?
Doing all right, not bad.
No, last time I spoke to you, I think you were you in Morocco?
I was in Morocco.
How was Morocco?
Morocco's all right. It's nice. The weather's definitely a lot better than here.
Yeah. Well, it's starting to warm up. How are you? Are you throwing yourself back into politics?
And yeah, it's busy now in the council. Obviously, we have to play our part in the election, yeah. But we've got a lot of we've got our budget coming up soon. So that'll be interesting.
So, you know, interestingly enough, recently we did a show, before we get to the stories of this week. We were talking to different councillors and different councils about the difficulty of the budgets that local councils have. Some have declared that they're insolvent or going bankrupt. I think we spoke to Birmingham and others about the difficulties that they're facing. How's Westminster looking?
Westminster, thankfully, we're okay. We're not in a position that other councils, other boroughs are in. We still have to make savings, so cuts.
But you're feeling the pressure as well.
Absolutely, just everyone as any other borough is, especially in Westminster of all places, yeah.
So, first story of the week, as you will be very astutely aware of, and that is that Labour will supposedly act to block people not fit to be MPs. Shadow Defence Secretary John Healey has pledged, as the party struggles to deal with an ongoing row about comments made by its candidates. He insisted the party was diligent when picking candidates to be MPs, but added, "You can't see everything everywhere." This is following a row about the Rochdale candidate, Azhar Ali, who has now had the support of the Labour Party withdrawn from him, though it's too late, so he's going to appear on the ballot with the Labour Party next to him. He did initially apologise. I've just seen this morning that he's now saying, you know, he's campaigning essentially as an independent, I was sacked, which brings the apology into question. Not long after that, another candidate was suspended for different comments. The Conservatives have also suspended a mayor and a parish councillor, I believe. What is your take on the way that we select candidates, not just in the Labour Party, but more broadly?
Well, I think with selections in general, they really need to be ground up. It really needs to come from the community. It needs to come from local residents. And to an extent, maybe it needs to go wider than the political parties. Because obviously you would know, it's normally that whoever's sort of involved locally as a Labour member or a Conservative member, they'll get the first choice and first dibs. But that sort of excludes quite a few people. So again, we have an election to solve that. People vote at the end. But it's, I don't know, I don't feel as it's inclusive enough.
So that's, isn't that the worry that, you know, while I completely understand and agree with having the highest standards of politicians, if we veer into anyone who's ever said anything, myself included, everyone knows it, you can read, I wrote a whole chapter about it in the book, go and buy the book, it's wonderful, it's brilliant. You know, if you exclude anyone who's ever said anything that is inappropriate, then essentially what you're saying is that
you won't get anywhere.
The politicians you're getting are the Etonian Oxbridge type that have sort of been just chiselled from birth for public office.
Even those have done probably more worse things, but seem to get away with it. So it's what I would say in this particular circumstance, it was a bit wobbly. Mm-hmm. It was really wobbly, especially the change of opinion almost throughout the day. It was like an hourly update.
So the first thing that came out was he said, I'm talking about Azhar Ali in Rochdale. So what happened was he said, that October 7th was allowed to happen, I believe, so that Israel is given the green light to go into Gaza, the sort of truther conspiracy theory. Yeah. He then apologized for that. Initially, Labour wouldn't withdraw their support and said, you know, they accept the apology and that things would be investigated. But you had shadow cabinet members continuing to campaign for him, continue to do media rounds supporting him.
On the same day.
And then after the media pressure, that seemed to U-turn about a day or so later. Yeah. And now we're in this huge row about how we select candidates. One of the things that I thought you said that was interesting that I agree with is surely the best quality mark for a candidate are the local people.
Yeah, I think it always is, whether it's for a councillor, whether it's for an MP, whoever it is. If they can't get their local people on side, if they don't have the backing of the community, then they shouldn't be the local representative.
Local people know better what other local people in that constituency want and find desirable than some fella sat in Labour HQ in Victoria.
And this is why I'd even say to go as far as saying it should be people who live in the area. We shouldn't have people drop shipped into God knows where from different areas. Let's try and get local people. We have people in every area who can stand and be great MPs. So why not give them first dibs rather than bringing in whoever from elsewhere? And I know Azhar, I think, was a local councillor. Yeah. But it's sort of... We need to decide as a party what the stand is. Do we sort of kick someone out straight away? Are we supporting them? Are we going to carry on? We can't send senior sort of shadow ministers in the daytime and then in the evening sort of take it away. It sets everyone up for failure, and that's not great.
And so I just want to ask quickly, while we're on the topic of Labour more generally, last couple of weeks, obviously since the war in Gaza has intensified, there's been a lot of criticism from the Muslim community. You are, you know, one of the best known at one point Muslim councillors around the country. Tell me about how you're feeling. We've had lots of Muslim, you know, we had MPs and councillors and everyone talk to us here about how difficult things have been and some of the feelings of frustration, anger, betrayal, hurt from the community. Where are you?
Well, I think day by day, the situation is getting a lot sadder, if that's the correct word. It's not improving. It's getting worse and worse. And for us as local councillors, we have to think what part can we play in this sort of big puzzle.
Well, you face the intensity of the pressure, don't you? Because and we had a guest on last week who's former London Assembly member, and he was saying, you know, it's you guys that are going out door knocking within the community and feeling the heat of what national politicians say. Yeah.
And we have to be able to understand the point of view from residents, obviously. But also match that with our personal views. And I think a lot of people forget that is still human. We still have our own independent sort of personal views. But then again, we do have to represent the views of those who elect us. And because that's our job ultimately. So I think for me, especially in Westminster, we've got massive communities, quite diverse from all over the place. But it's quite tricky to say, I'm obviously 100% for ceasefire. And it's like, why haven't we nationally done that?
Yeah, what are you hearing on the door? Is it coming up? Is it breaking through?
Yeah, occasionally, especially in parts that we represent, so like Lisson Grove or High Road or Queen's Park, places like that.
Yeah.
People just want it to stop. Ultimately, it doesn't matter what side they're sort of supporting; they want it to stop.
And I prefaced it with Muslims, but of course, it's not just Muslims. We got a poll today out by YouGov showing that the majority of the British public want the fighting to stop and want an immediate ceasefire, and that number has massively jumped since. Absolutely. November. We're going to move on to the next story, and that is Michael Gove has vowed that no-fault evictions will be banned this year, as he warned separately that democracy was under threat if young people were shut out from owning their own homes in the future. Ministers have come under fire in recent days from campaigners who have said its bill to It's a bill to get rid of so-called Section 21 evictions in England, whereby landlords can remove tenants for no reason. That bill is inadequate. That's the criticism that the government is receiving. The ban was also a pledge made in the Conservatives' 2019 manifesto. However, the UK housing minister insisted in an interview on Sunday that the practice would have ended by the time of a general election, despite his previous concerns that the courts may not be able to cope. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of the policy, in fact, I don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty of the policy, if I'm honest. I want to focus more on the theme of what Michael Gove is trying to touch on, and that is an entire generation of young people who have no realistic prospect of getting on the housing ladder. Is that something that resonates with you?
Absolutely. Well, I'm 24. I'm at the age where I'm sort of thinking, what happened next? I'm still living at home. So yeah. I spent all my years as a councillor, as Lord Mayor, living at home with family. Absolutely love it. Don't get me wrong, it's great.
Yeah, make sure you say that again for mum. Yeah.
I was say, yeah, it's great. It's fantastic. Mum absolutely loves me being there. Fantastic. Yeah. But it's owning your own home isn't possible.
It's just it's not like, in your thinking,
it's not
right?
It's even a dream. Yeah. Like, it genuinely isn't even a dream. We're not allowed to believe or have hope that one day we're going to own a house, especially where I live in Westminster. They build a one-bedroom.
I said this on a different radio network, which you should only ever listen to FUBAR, obviously. Absolutely. But we were in a panel discussion, and we were talking about housing. And I said, listen, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm 29 and just recently got married. And I said, the discussions I've had with my wife is just realistically, we don't think we'll be able to own a home by 40, for example. And there was a fella that was like 50, 60s, something, shocked. He was like, how old? But that's the reality, right? It's not just Ali Milani saying that, right?
Forget owning a home. It's renting.
Renting, yeah.
Where can you genuinely afford, especially in London or central London, to afford to rent?
Yeah.
If you're paying over 2K for one bedroom, that's most people's salary after tax. If you're on a sort of normal salary of 30K sort of thing, where can you genuinely live to sort of afford to live? And that's why we see young people. That's why we have problems like overcrowding.
Yeah.
It's because generations grow up and the flat might have been okay when they moved in, but it's not okay.
I'll give you an example of that. I've got a friend right now who's having his first baby with his wife, and they're both around my age, both working. One of them is a scientist, one of them works in the civil service, and they're having to move to Preston to be able to afford to live in the space that can physical space that can accommodate their newborn baby. So that's just reality. That's renting, by the way. That's not buying. Yeah. So the housing market is completely shut out. So in a sense, I'm going to wash my mouth out with salt after this, but Michael Gove is right, no?
He's right, but let's be realistic here. These are, especially Michael Gove has been in government for a little while. He sort of knows what he's doing. And I think this is the last leg of a election campaigning or pioneering, trying to get something through. But really and truly, none of these people genuinely understand what it feels like to be on the ground.
So what do we have to do? What would you know, as a young person, what would give you a little bit more confidence in being able to get on the housing ladder? Is it building more? Is it these no-fault evictions?
Well, the definition of affordable is useless, which we know and have known. Mm-hmm. In Westminster, we're lucky enough to be able to buy flats from sort of developers and say these are social housing units, these are council flats. We're reviewing the allocations policy, so we're seeing who's actually eligible for social housing. Because for me, it's I believe in the idea of social housing. I believe in the state and local government being responsible for where people are able to live. It shouldn't be always a personal sort of, I want to go and buy this and buy that. And if I'm being realistic, we'll never be able to bring house prices down in Westminster, for example, or even London. It's never going to change. It's only going to go up and up. Because of the value of the land, the amount of people who live there, some of the most densely populated areas, everyone wants to live in London.
What about rent controls? Something similar to what they've done in New York or in Spain?
I think rent controls would be interesting.
Mr. Deek Khan has come out in favour of it.
Well, we've got intermediate rent, which isn't far off, and the GLA set sort of a standard. So I think it's about £1,000 for one bedroom, etc., and it sort of gradually goes up. Mm-hmm. And that something like that, I think, would be really nice. But if it was, again, enforced by law, it can't be on the goodwill of landlords, because there isn't such thing, unfortunately. It's a business, it's a market. You have a house, you're going to rent it out, you want to try and make as much money as possible.
But look, I mean, specifically in London, I think one of the problems we've got is and this is where some of the, you know, people think this policy is extreme. I can't understand why it is, but the reason why the land is so expensive and the reason why the market just trends upwards is we've got so much property, land, flats, just housing units in London that are bought by oligarchs from abroad you know, whether it's from the Middle East, whether it's from China or Russia, or and they're left empty.
Well, we've got a big empty home scheme that we're doing at the moment in Westminster.
Well, why can't the government come in and say, right, you either rent it out or you lose it? You can't just leave property empty.
The thing, they should, and we try to do that as a local council, but the legislation isn't there to back us. So we go to someone who's
We're talking about national government.
Yeah, national government. But they need to empower us as a local authority, because we know where the houses are, we know where the flats are. We go to someone at the moment, they say, go away. It's nothing to do with you.
But
sort of thing.
would that not radically change things? If, as a national government, let's say I was a national government and I came to you and I said, look, there's X amount of empty properties. We've given them 6 months, a year, Absolutely. 2 years
Absolutely.
To either rent it or lose it. And once they lose it, you can, you know, compulsory purchase it and put it back on the market.
But this is the catch, though. Even in Westminster, even if we were to compulsory purchase and issue a CPO, can we afford the price of the property itself? Is it worth us buying something for $8 million?
But if that goes alongside a radical housing program, for example, building housing, surely it's easier to buy than to build.
Absolutely. And we're dying to have more space and find sort of more flats.
Amazing. So we're going to move on to the next story. This is amazing, by the way. We had to fact check this twice.
Yeah.
It's true, right? I'm telling you this is true before full fact come at me for the second time in 2 weeks. The Home Office will pay celebrities to post messages on TikTok. I'm just going to let everybody digest what I've just said. And I'm going to say it again. The Home Office will pay celebrities to post messages on TikTok, urging migrants not to cross the channel in small boats. Social media influencers in countries that account for a large amount of illegal migration to the UK will be offered thousands of pounds to publicise new immigration laws, including the threat of deportation to Rwanda. The decision to pay influencers to engage prospective migrants is described as novel in a government document. The mass advertisement campaign will take place in Albania, Iraq, Egypt, Vietnam, with plans to introduce them in Turkey and India. Hamza, this is what we needed. This is what was missing to stop the boats was TikToks.
Well, if you're a TikToker with a lack of morals, you've won the lottery, essentially. There's nothing better than government funding.
Yeah, just British government funding to post TikToks. Yeah.
I think I did see a guy, and I think Nigel Farage actually reposted this guy on Twitter, mm-hmm. and he was sort of saying, oh, what happens if you catch a migrant in your house or whatever? And he's like, oh, get out. And you get hundreds of thousands of views, and that influences people. Mm-hmm. This is what these people are, they're influencers. And that, for me, is not the right way of spending public money.
This is just bang out of ideas. Right? It's like you've not at the bottom of the barrel. You've scraped the barrel. You've gone through to the concrete below.
You're in a different world at this rate. Yeah. I think that whoever sits around those tables in government and looks at this and said, this is a fantastic idea, let's do it.
Do you think this is a real policy, or do you think this is just reactionary?
I wouldn't be surprised, honestly. I don't put anything past the current government. There are no limits. There are no rules, as they say. they can do what they want, pretty much.
Right, we're gonna move swiftly past that because it doesn't deserve any more of our time, and that's story number four, which is fake audio clips of Sadiq Khan criticizing Remembrance Weekend events and encouraging pro-Palestinian marches nearly caused a serious disorder, the London mayor has said. The so-called deepfake material shared on social media had an AI simulation of Mr. Khan's voice saying he did not care about the Remembrance Weekend and suggesting the commemorations be postponed to allow for a pro-Palestine march to go ahead. Mr. Khan told BBC Radio 4's Why Do You Hate Me podcast that current legislation is not fit for purpose, and the audio creator got away with it after Metropolitan Police said the material did not constitute a criminal offence. I mean, this is going to be a serious problem in the coming years, isn't it? Just serious fake news, misinformation via deepfakes and AI creations, essentially getting politicians to say all sorts. Keir Starmer has faced it, Sadiq Khan's faced it.
I saw one on Facebook yesterday of Keir, and it had sort of the voice, and you can see sort of the audio lines going up and down.
It sounds really realistic.
It sounds really legit. Yeah. And I was telling my friends, I was like, there's no way he said that. I was like, there's no way. They're like, no, but it's it. And I was like, no way. And I had to sort of double check it as well on Google. I was like, there's no way he can be saying stuff like that. But people get caught out, and people post these, and things spread really, really quickly, especially if there's a community that's gathered for the purpose of hate.
Yeah.
Things like this will just fly through.
I remember the big one was around Labour Party conference. I don't know if you remember, but someone posted one of Keir Starmer just completely tearing a new one to a supposed intern, just effing and blinding. And it sounded so realistic. I thought it was real, right? I was like, what? And it's very, you know.
It's scary because, like I said, these things spread like a wildfire. And they'll only get worse. And as the technology adapts and people start to learn how to use these things, you can get it on your phone and do it in 10 seconds.
And you can't put the genie back in the bottle. That's the problem. As much as corrections can be put out, if 2 million people listen to or watch the deep fake misinformation of Sadiq Khan saying he doesn't care about commemoration day, it's game over, like game you said, right? Because that is always going to get more views than a correction saying it's not true. Absolutely, so that it's absolutely. Already out there.
And it has real world impacts. This is going to affect people's lives quite literally.
And so what do we need to look at? Some legislative changes to make sure that they're criminal offences?
It has to be legislation, has to be awareness. I think we have to start teaching these in sort of in schools and colleges and that sort of thing, and let people know the consequences of the same way we do with any other online thing. This is now an online thing that we have to make people aware of, especially families and stuff, especially people who maybe might not have English as first language, because then they'll see something like this, a prominent figure, and it will only spread. And I've seen my parents and my mum sort of and auntie's WhatsApp groups and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it just spreads anything like crazy.
Anything will spread.
All right, well, thank you so much. That's been Councillor Hamza Tawzal, former Lord Mayor of Westminster, current councillor, Labour Party councillor, joining us for the Week Unwrapped. Hamza, thank you so much for joining us. We are going to be speaking next about mortgages. We're going to continue on the theme of first-time buyers, and we are going to be joined by Vincent Hornsby, Mortgage and Protection Advisor at the Mortgage Advice Bureau. He joins us after these messages.
FUBAR Radio presents...
Access all areas. We have the absolute icon, legend, Janice Dickinson.
I'm here.
Do you still enjoy doing reality shows, or do you now see it as more of like a part of your job that you like have to do?
I do really enjoy it. I don't enjoy the actuality of eating fish eyeballs.
Well, yeah, there's that side to Amazon.
Yeah. Or a vagina of cow.
Yeah. But you do like the sort of social side, do you? Like just
the social side was fantastic. Just getting to know people and sleeping with people and eating with people when we didn't really have enough food.
Access all areas.
Every Wednesday.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio at Politics Uncensored. We've just had Hamza, our councillor, Labour Party councillor and former Lord Mayor of Westminster, joining us in the studio. And we spoke a little bit about the housing crisis, particularly in London. And we're going to continue on the theme of housing and particularly mortgages, as according to recent research from Halifax, over 60% of first-time buyer mortgages taken out between January and December 2023 were in joint names with two or more people. Housing Secretary Michael Gove has recently said that he was pressing the Treasury to include measures around housing affordability to be included in the next month's budget, including a cut to stamp duty, state-backed 99% mortgages, and an extension of the discount scheme for first-time buyers. Gove also warned that a collapse in home ownership among young people is a threat to democracy, as well as conservative electoral fortunes, and a radical steps were needed to make housing more affordable. Joining me now, we have Vincent Hornsby, Mortgage and Protection Advisor at the Mortgage Advice Bureau. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us. Can you give us a sense of how bad the market is right now for first-time buyers?
Yes, good evening. The market is tough to get onto as a first-time buyer. You know, if you're paying rent at the moment, you're paying, I don't know, £750 a month in rent for a one-bedroom place will be £27,000 that basically has gone into somebody else's pocket and it's not as part of your deposit. So the younger people are having to try and find various new ways of getting onto the mortgage market. And it's a tough market to get onto. And that's why we basically would like to see that home ownership be feeling achievable rather than a complete stretch.
And so these figures from Halifax, which suggest that 60% of first-time buyers, first-time buyer mortgages are being taken out by more than one person. What does that mean? Is it that people simply cannot afford it on their own and they're having to pull in together?
Yes, absolutely. So people having to pull in together. We found a big increase in joint borrower, sole proprietor. So that's where one person is on the deeds, only one person owns a property, but parents, for example, are coming on to support the mortgage lender to get the affordability where it needs to be, and then they come off at a later stage. So we've got things like that happening. But we are finding people who are buying with friends because they just don't have the income. The affordability has changed. Interest rates have increased, inflation's increased, amount of deposits increased. So people are doubling up and buying properties themselves.
And what are the risks associated with that?
Well, the risks are, you've got to have a good friend. There are always material changes in life, aren't there? So, who knows when you're going to meet your next partner? Who knows when, something's going to change, job move, anything like that, which can affect two people rather than one. And then you've got to have a look at, well, what are the options thereafter? So it can be a risk, but it will get you onto the housing market.
MAB has recently found that 23% of 18 to 24-year-olds are planning to team up to buy a home. This seems to be a particular problem with the younger generation and their feeling. I mean, I've just had Hamza, who's a counsellor, 24 years old, in the studio with me, who's talking about, you know, buying a home is not in his perception of his future is not a realistic possibility. How much of a crisis is it if you have an entire generation that feels disconnected from the housing market?
Well, I mean, given the volatile mortgage market and economy, it is reasonable to say that aspiring homeowners are increasingly looking to buy with others as opposed to going on solo. So with interest rates and inflation high, combining finances of two can help. Whilst there's a little data on how common it is for friends to buy together, research has shown more than half, 52% of prospective buyers say the current economic climate has impacted who they plan on buying a property with. And moreover, 7% say they now plan to buy with a friend. That is rising to 23% of 18 to 24-year-olds. So you can see the percentage of people looking to get onto the market in that younger age group are having to do it together.
So can you explain, old Denzel Washington quote, explain it to me like I'm 5 years old. Why? Why is the market so unaffordable?
Because of house prices. House prices have shot up. They continue to rise. You see on the news, you know, one building society says it increases by 1%. The next bank says it's decreased by 1%. But the value of houses have gone up to such a level. And with interest rates increasing, the amount of money that the lender will lend on their affordability models, if interest rates go up, payments go up, therefore income levels are stretched and the affordability comes down. So what's basically happened is a few years ago, post-pandemic, we had a boom in the mortgage market and the housing market. Interest rates were so low, the affordability models were high, so people could borrow more. As interest rates have risen, the affordability available based on those higher interest rates is lower. So that's why we've seen...
So I want, if you don't mind, I just want to unpack things because listeners might not be completely understand what we mean when we talk about affordability. So this is the amount, the affordability models you're talking about. So this is the amount. So if I go to a bank and look for a mortgage, what you're talking about in affordability models is how much that bank is willing to lend me.
Absolutely.
To buy the house.
If you go back 20 years, you know, banks would say it's four times your income, four and a half times your income, etc. We've had to get a lot smarter with lending, especially with regulation. So the banks and building societies, when they look at how much they can lend to you on a mortgage, will have a look at what you've got coming into the household and what you've got going out. So if you've got credit card debts, personal loans, maintenance payments, etc., that all comes off your income when they're actually looking at doing the calculations. So the less outgoings you've got, the more you'll borrow, but the more debts you've got, and they will take into account, as I said, your credit cards, car finance, HP, student loans, all of these type of things are taken into account. Now, the different banks and building societies have different models based on their policies. So some may lend slightly higher than others, and some may lend less than others. And that's why using a mortgage broker, when you can look at the whole of the market, we can actually probably find lenders that may be able to just stretch you that little bit more.
And how, so exactly why are the housing prices going up so rapidly?
Well,
I mean, there won't be one reason,
but it's a lack of stock. If you actually look at the number of people now within the country who are wanting to get onto the housing market, talking to state agents and local estate agents, you know, they're sending people around to take the pictures, and they've got a whole list of people who are looking for the property. So there's just not enough housing stock for people to buy.
So we need to build more
in the housing market, this sort of the cheaper end.
So then the call surely has to be, we have to build more houses.
Well, yes, we've got to build more houses. We've got to look at different ways of doing different things. I mean, you mentioned Michael Gove earlier on in his article. I mean, I'm not here to discuss the political impact, but what we want to see is that home ownership feels achievable for people, and that there's changes that can be made to this. You know, we've had previously the Help to Buy scheme, shared ownership, etc. But the new 99% mortgage initiative could be what we are desperately needing to help many people climb onto that first rung of the ladder, especially those who've been living with parents. So if you've been living with your parent, you haven't been renting anywhere. You've got no historical evidence that you can afford it. So in the very short term, the focus should be on those that are on rental. And if you've been renting somewhere for 2 or 3 years and you've been making these payments and you've never missed a payment, and the mortgage payment is going to be a similar level, if not less than what you're paying in rent, why can't these people get onto the mortgage market? That's why something like this could, in the short term, really help. I mean, a move like that would acknowledge that the costs that renters have been having month in, month out, it would increase home ownership, it would stimulate property transaction, and it would boost our sort of flatlining economy. Stamp duty reform, not stamp duty hold, they want a whole reform of it. I mean, the conveyancing people who are actually processing the transaction, it's a nightmare for them, and we need to...
Do you mind, sorry, if I might, do you mind explaining what stamp duty is for folks who might not know what
stamp it is? Stamp duty is tax that you pay when you purchase a property. It depends on the value of the property. First-time buyers won't be paying stamp duty if they're purchasing less than a certain level, and all the levels rise up. If you buy a second property, i.e. you become a landlord, or you buy a second home, you're going to be paying a significantly higher amount of stamp duty. It's tax, basically, on the purchase of a house.
All right, and I just want to... One last question on this stock issue, because we've just spoken about it with Hamza. One of the key issues we have in London, we know, is there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, depending on what data you believe, of empty properties just sat here in London that are often, not always, but often owned by overseas oligarchs and billionaires who use it either for tax purposes or visit it maybe once or twice a year. Building houses takes a long time. Why can't the government say to these foreign nationals, these oligarchs, these billionaires, use it or lose it, and we'll put compulsory purchase it back to help the stock?
Not a question I can answer, if I'm honest with you, Ali. I'm not in the politics side of things. I'm a mortgage broker. I will help you.
But Vincent, tell the truth. It's a great idea. I've just come up with it. It's an awesome idea. You're not going to be able to do that. It's okay.
It's an idea, but it's about tackling
that stock, isn't it? We just don't have enough houses, so we've got to come up with radical ways to get more stock in to push prices down.
Just look at the high street. How many shops are empty now, and what's happening with those? You know, those can be converted into homes. The high street is not what it was 30 years ago. The world's moving. Everybody's purchasing online. Therefore, we've got a lot of stock in housing, in town centres. These could all be developed. Yeah.
So I have a couple more questions for you while I've got you. Let's talk about the banks a little bit more. What incentive is being given to them to lend? What is the weather like in that sector? Are they hesitant to lend, or what's going on there?
No, they're very willing to lend. The banks and building societies are getting quite competitive. And as their own finance market changes, there are times where they've got the funding where they can actually reduce the interest rates and purchase rates that are lower than their competitors, which is great. So what you'll see is within the mortgage industry, we will be putting mortgages to banks and building societies, and it changes. So we might get Santander 1 month that's really competitive. It could be then NatWest the next month. It could be Nationwide and then the Halifax. So they're all competing for this business. We want more first-time buyers, definitely. We need more first-time buyers. Remortgage market, where you actually already own a property and have a mortgage with them, but you actually have coming to an end of a particular product, a fixed rate or a tracker or something like that. That market is very, very big, because a few years ago we had that big boom after the lockdown, where people wanted to buy a house with a garden. They wanted to downsize. They wanted an office in their house, so they needed a bigger house. All of those transactions are now starting to mature, and that market is very large for the banks and the building
societies. But on the banks and the building societies, I presume we want them to be lending more, because what I mean more is the amount they're willing to lend, because the prices are going up so high, for example, it might encourage more first-time buyers. People like myself, for example, who find it very difficult to buy in London because it's so expensive to in London, but also can't leave London because our work is so tied into London, then we're forced to rent. And, you know, we might be able to make the monthly, and I'm really glad you used the rental example, because it's a great example. The rent we pay is far more than we would have paid in a mortgage, for example, what the banks would give us. But the amount that's being lended isn't high enough. Is there some way that we can encourage the banks and building societies to, rather than lending 4.5 times someone's salary, it goes to 10 times maybe?
It's got to be affordable. It's got to be realistic. 10 times somebody's income.
No, I just use that number as a thingy, but I mean just driving it up.
Yeah, yeah. What we've got to do is work within the regulations, and the regulations state that, you know, we need to ensure that a mortgage is affordable, and the clients, the customers need to ensure they have sufficient protection in place. If anything were to happen to themselves health-wise, a death to a party, something like that, we want to ensure that that mortgage is protected and cleared. If we start lending 5, 6, 7 times worth of income, and you're working in, I don't know, an industry where the business is shut down, all of a sudden you don't have a job. The income that you've got is so reduced and your mortgage payments are ridiculously high. We've got to protect the customer. So the banks and building societies have got to be realistic in the amounts that they're lending, which is understandable. If you're an underwriter, you're protecting that business. But there are schemes out there depending. Now, a lot of people in London, they are working through a career, they're professionals, and the banks and building societies do have schemes available for professionals where they will look at increasing the multiples, because somebody who's just become a doctor or a conveyancer or something like this, you know, we know that income is going to shoot up in the coming years, therefore they may consider lending a higher amount.
Okay,
so there are schemes.
So a couple more, actually two key questions, just advice based questions. If someone from government is listening, either current government, future government, and you had their ear for 60 seconds, Vincent, what would a piece of advice that you could give to help improve the housing market as a whole, but also specifically young people getting on the housing market?
Specifically for young people, I definitely would be talking to them about the 99% initiative. It would kick everything off straight away. If you're in rented, I would say to any party, I would say if you're renting a property and you're paying out £27,000 over 3 years, just in a low rent of £750 a month, but you only need 1% to purchase a property rather than a 5 or 10% deposit these days, that would change the market hugely.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain the 99% initiative?
So 99%. So imagine a house is worth £100,000. Your deposit on a 99% scheme would be £1,000. People who are paying rent can save £1,000.
I mean, that's huge, because we've quoted on this show before research that's just in London, and I don't want to hark too much about London, but I love the city and it's where I'm from. It's deposits on average are £100,000.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all
I mean, the only way I'll be honest, Vincent, the only way I'm saving £100,000 is to sell you one of my kidneys. I don't know if it's going for that much.
Absolutely. But what if it was 1% that you needed?
Then I would definitely be buying. What you've just said would radically shift my, just individually, Ali Milani, as a 29-year-old who right now doesn't have a dream of getting on the housing ladder, that would definitely change things.
So that would change things. But imagine then the housing stock, the turnover of housing stock, more people buying. The economy, you've got more people doing things to properties, more people decorating, more people upgrading, more people renovating. So there's jobs for electricians, there's jobs for builders, there's jobs for plumbers. It has a huge, the housing market is the cornerstone of the economy. And if we could get something like that going, wow, it would be a big difference.
Brilliant. And last question I have for you is the individuals that are listening, what advice would you give if they desperately want to get onto the housing ladder?
Talk to a mortgage broker. I talk to so many people who have listened to their parents. Their parents bought a house 25, 30 years ago. The market's different. Everything's different. Talk to a mortgage broker. They will then talk to you about the process, how much you actually need to save. I've got people saying to me they need a £100,000 deposit. When I sit down with them, I work it out, and they need a £25,000 deposit. And they're sitting there going, well, I can actually start looking for a house. Talk to a mortgage broker. Get the honest truth from a reputable broker, and find out what you can do. I get amazed how many stories I get from customers when I'm explaining the housing market, the mortgage market, the process of buying a house, what they need, the costs involved. And they sit there saying, I didn't think I could do it, but I can. So there's a lot of people out there, a lot of negativity out there regarding mortgages and the house buying process. Talk to somebody. Find out what the options are, and you'd be quite amazed.
Thank you so much. That was enormously informative, Vincent, and I'm sure listeners will have found it really, really interesting and helpful, particularly young people, I think, who my generation, certainly amongst friends, colleagues, have almost given up in a certain extent on housing. And I think listening to some of your advice would have certainly opened some eyes and made some headway in informing people about how they can get on the housing ladder. Thank you so much. That was Vincent Hornsby, a mortgage and protection advisor at the Mortgage Advice Bureau, joining us down the line. We are now going to switch onto a different topic, and that is the good old United States of America. We're going to be talking about the upcoming presidential elections, which are likely to see potential criminal Donald Trump versus everybody's granddad, Joe Biden.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what's so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it, like I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him, and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV, and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about
standing.
Cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani at Politics Uncensored. We are talking about the upcoming presidential elections in the United States of America, and specifically the questions around the candidates. Current former president and potential criminal Donald Trump is likely to become the candidate for the Republican Party, whilst sitting president Joe Biden is leading in the votes for the Democrats. So we're likely to see Trump-Biden 2 at the next elections in the United States. However, a recent damning report from the special counsel Robert Hur has called into question Biden's mental state, with a recent poll from ABC suggesting that 86% of Americans believe Biden is too old to serve another term. AP NORC poll suggested that 77% of Americans think Biden is too old to serve four more years, whereas 51% thought the same of Trump. It's important to note that Joe Biden is currently 81 years old and Donald Trump is 77. I'm just going to read a quote out from that Robert Hur special counsel report, and he referred to Joe Biden as an elderly man with a poor memory. Joining us now is John Bowden, Washington correspondent at The Independent. John, thank you so much for joining us, I think, from Washington. How big of a story is Joe Biden's memory and mental capacity and faculties in America?
Well, look, it's completely consumed Washington this past week. Both the initial release of the report and the president's reaction to it. I don't know if you saw the press conference that he gave last week when the or a few days ago when the report came out. He gave a very animated and angry and frankly energetic response to the report, which in itself ended up raising more questions about his memory issues, about his speech capabilities, his mental capabilities, because during that speech he confused the president of Mexico with the president of Egypt while talking about the Israel-Gaza conflict. So it was a bad story for the president that got worse with the White House's response. And as you said, it's a major story in U.S. politics because of how much of a concern it is for voters around the country. You mentioned clear majorities of Americans believe Mr. Biden is too old to serve for a second term. I would only add that those same polls include clear majorities of Democrats think that same thing, that Mr. Biden is too old to serve. And to be clear, as you said, many of these concerns exist around President Trump as well. President Trump is himself one of the oldest candidates to ever run for office, and himself has been noticed or reported to have been making more of these sort of confusing gaffes in public at his campaign rallies in recent weeks. The most significant and noteworthy example being him confusing Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House, at a campaign rally, in one fairly famous example.
Mm-hmm. I think.
But as you say,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask, I think what's interesting and key about it is typically, whether it's here in the United Kingdom or in the United States, these attacks come from your opponents. But it seems from all the polling, and not just polling, but relative reasonable heads like Nate Silver, who wouldn't necessarily pile on in a partisan way on the president, or even David Axelrod, who is a well-established Democrat and advisor to the Democratic Party, are all now publicly saying it, that there might be an issue here.
Yeah, so we are technically in primary season, even if the Democratic Party would like you to think otherwise. Joe Biden is essentially going to wrap up the Democratic primary. Dean Phillips is not a serious contender for the nomination at this point. So most Democrats are essentially caught in this between a rock and hard place, right? They've got, on one side, they've got very clear majorities of both their own party and voters nationally saying that this is a problem for them that they need to address. But at the same time, there is a relative acceptance throughout the party that the primary is decided and Joe Biden is the general election candidate for the Democrats in 2024. And if that's the case, any highlighting of criticism or concerns about the president's age essentially fall into the territory of aiding the Republicans for the general election. And so on one hand, you have very legitimate concerns that your voters are raising and want you to deal with during a primary season, which theoretically is the time to hash out these problems or these concerns. On the other hand, It's a primary season by name only, and Joe Biden is going to be the Democratic nominee unless he steps aside of his own volition. Mm-hmm. So Democrats really are stuck here. They can't, many of them want to or would be raising these concerns if they had a better avenue to do so. But instead, they are stuck sort of explaining away the president's issues or dismissing these concerns as Republican talk.
So if I may ask you ahead of, you know, obviously we all know things can and often do change between now and election season, but I mean Joe Biden's only his only problem isn't just his memory and his age. He's got 56% disapproval rating right now according to 538. As I understand, no president has been re-elected with such numbers at this stage of their presidency, or at least near these numbers. what do his prospects look like? What are the electoral consequences of what we're talking about? You know, is he in serious trouble as it pertains to taking on Donald Trump at their next general election?
There are definite concerns about his, about how competitive the election is going to be in November, to be sure. That said, we are in the time of Donald Trump, as it were, and unprecedented things are happening all the time these days. And yes, Joe Biden's favorables are lower right now than his opponents were, I believe, at the same time in his presidency. Yes, they are, traditionally, this would look horrific for a re-election campaign. However, at the same time, Donald Trump also has historic unfavorable ratings. In every poll, there's something like 45% of voters who say they don't have just a unfavorable opinion of him, but a very unfavorable opinion. Mm-hmm. There's a very large contingent of voters in this country who are wholly turned off by Donald Trump and Trumpism, and are motivated to vote against that faction whenever it appears on the ballot. Mm-hmm.
Could that be a saving grace for the Biden campaign, that there is a huge caucus of Americans who, even if they have huge concerns about Biden's age, memory, and mental capacity, would just vote against Trump come what may?
That's really looking like it's going to be the case. We're seeing more and more polls come out every day that suggest that the group of Americans, the percentage of Americans who are fully unwilling to vote for Donald Trump is going to rise if he is convicted in any one of his 91 felony counts. That's a serious problem for the Trump campaign. This includes we did some reporting in the appendix. This includes majorities of voters in swing states, including, I think, 1 in 4 Republicans and some, at least 4 in 10 independent voters who say they will fully not even consider a Republican ticket if the nominee is a convicted felon. That's another unprecedented part of the Trump reality is the Biden campaign can potentially look to the general election and say that there's just massive, massive portions of voters in purple states that he needs to win, like Arizona, Michigan, Georgia, who are very turned off by what happened in 2020 and in 2021. And are just simply not willing to go through with that again, and will hold their nose essentially and pull the lever for Joe Biden, not out of love for Joe Biden, but out of fear or perhaps just tiredness of Donald Trump.
If I can shift you back to Joe Biden and the questions around his capabilities as a candidate, typically in these kinds of things, the best way to get forward and get ahead of it is to send your candidate out. If there are questions about your candidate, you prepare him or her and send them out, and that's the best thing to do. Seems like that hasn't worked for Joe Biden. There's now huge anxieties. The story doesn't seem to be going away. I want to ask from a technical perspective, bearing in mind our audiences are largely British, what could the Democratic Party do? Is there anything they can do to replace their candidate or to present a new candidate, or are they really strapped into the Joe Biden train and they have to see it to the end?
So the nominating contest is decided by these people called delegates, who are picked up by the respective candidates after each primary contest, state by state, across the country. Right now, Joe Biden is cleaning up in the delegate count. And if he walks into the convention in the summer with enough delegates to secure the nomination on the first ballot, then no, there's nothing the party can do to replace him without essentially negotiating behind the scenes and asking him to step aside. That's not going to happen because the DNC is currently chaired by a Biden loyalist, Jimmy Harrison of South Carolina. And so realistically, that's not really an option at this point. Dean Phillips himself actually spent most of last year trying to recruit a more prominent primary challenger against Joe Biden because he thought that was the most feasible way of replacing the candidate for the Democrats this year, and that didn't work. So now he's running as that alternative, and barring a massive change of fortune for the Dean Phillips campaign, no, there's not going to be a different Democratic nominee unless Joe Biden is the one who makes that decision.
So in all likelihood, the current trajectory that we're on, in all likelihood, it's 81-year-old Joe Biden versus 77-year-old Donald Trump, who may or may not be in prison at the time.
And just about everyone in the country agrees on one thing, that they don't want to see that happen, but they also can't agree on an alternative.
And that is a wonderful place for us to leave it. That's John Bowden, our Washington correspondent at The Independent. Thank you so much for joining us from Washington, given the time differences, and talking with us through what seems to be a rock and a hard place for the electorate in the United States of America. Thank you, John, for joining us. We are now going on to, if you are a regular listener of the show, you know, is my favorite segment. And that is when we go out and hear what real people think. That's not a diss on myself or any of our guests who ever joined the show, but I'm always really interested to hear from ordinary folk out in the world, living their life and reacting to the issues that we talked about in our studio here. And this week we're kind of blending in this theme of mortgages that we spoke earlier on with Hamza and Vincent. And we asked people, according to Halifax, over 60% of mortgages taken out between January and December 2023 were in joint names with two or more people. Would you pair up with someone for a mortgage? And if so, who?
100%. Yeah. I hate the fact that I'm wasting money on rents when I could just be spending it on my own mortgage.
Do you not think it's risky?
I think it's just down to who you sort of do it with, you know? Like, if you can find the right person, then it's a really good investment, yeah.
I guess so, but I mean, it depends on the friend. Like, I would only move in with a friend that I was 100% certain that I wouldn't fall out with. So yes and no.
I guess so. I guess in like the cost of living, you need, it doesn't really make sense to have a place on your own, and having someone to share that with is sensible.
Yeah, I'd only be able to afford to move in with a friend. I wouldn't be able to. I live in Southwest London, and the house prices are still really expensive. But yeah, I'd move in with a friend or a family member. Absolutely.
I think it's a risky business getting into mortgages with friends and family, but equally it's risky getting into mortgages with anybody, and the way that the climate is at the moment with mortgages, I feel like it kind of has to happen. So I think I would if I needed to.
And there you go. I think what, you know, the common theme that there seemed to be that young people particularly were quite open to the idea of doing a joint mortgage with one or more person as well as themselves, and that seems to reflect the figures that we're looking at, where 60% of the mortgage being taken out were between two or more people. And everybody is highlighting obvious risks that come with that. You never know who you're going to be living with. I lived with two flatmates during university, and that did not go well. In fact, I was perfectly happy, but my two flatmates were so upset with each other at one point. True story, they wouldn't talk to each other and would only communicate through letters. So our dining room table in the living room would just have stacks of letters that they wrote to each other, full of sass, which is the only way that they would communicate, or through me. So imagine owning a mortgage with someone that you won't even speak to. There's obviously huge risks with that. But what we're hearing from the people on the street is that they are open to it. And that brings us to the end of what has been a jam-packed show, where we've spoken with Hamza Tawzil, a former Lord Mayor of Westminster, with The Week Unwrapped. We talked Labour politics. We talked Michael Gove, and we even spoke about deep fakes. Thank you to him for joining us. Vincent Hornsby brought us mortgage advice from the Mortgage Advice Bureau and spoke to us about what we have been speaking about, and that's the housing market. And John Bowden gave us an insight into American politics as the American electorate go to the polls, hoping they could vote for anybody but the two old men that will be on the ballot. Thank you so much to all of our guests for joining us this week. If you want, you can go back and listen to all of our previous shows, where we've had guests ranging from Lord Heseltine, to John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn and Clive Lewis MP, all of whom joined us in the studio. You can listen back to us to talk about topics like housing and many other things. Go back and listen via Spotify or all good podcasting platforms. You can follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, which is now known as X, or TikTok at FUBAR Radio and at Politics Uncensored. You can catch me at Ali Milani UK. I hope to see you all next week with another amazing jam-packed show. I'm Ali Milani. This is Politics Uncensored. Salams.